afternoon. This is Terry Lane with you in the National Interest on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. Today in the program we canvass the generosity of the Meyer family, and we also ask why the Rockefeller Foundation, another charitable foundation, would support open source gene technology. It sounds like the very antithesis of monopoly capitalism. Professor Richard Jefferson is the molecular biologist with the idea of applying the open source concept. That's the concept that's given us the Linux computer operating system and the Mozilla web browser, applying that principle to genetic engineering. Is it possible to assemble a cast of international scientists, motivated by nothing more than curiosity and the desire to do good, to produce useful organisms for third world farmers? Well, we'll see in a minute. And with personal philanthropy said to be on the increase due to changes to the tax rules, it's timely to take a look at one of the most venerable of charitable trusts, the Meyer Trust and subsequent foundation. A history of Meyer generosity has been written called A Tradition of Giving, and the author, Michael Liffman, will be along to talk about it later. But first, the newslets from here and there, and my thanks to Peter of Bicton in Western Australia for sending me the brochure from the State Department for Planning and Infrastructure, a brochure called A Senior? Renewing Your Driver's License Isn't Difficult. And the brochure in question is full of good advice on how to go about renewing your driver's license when you are over 75. But, as Peter says, the pamphlet shows just how fair and compassionate we West Australians are. Please see back of sample, he says. And on the back of the brochure it says, this document, now you're keeping in mind, aren't you, that this is how to renew your driver's license when you're over 70. This document is available in the following formats: audio tape, large print, or braille. They are equal opportunity devotees in Western Australia. Now, here's a little story from the Bega District News. Perhaps it does to remind ourselves of why we're so suspicious of politicians and the bureaucrats that serve them. Mr. Gerhard Weedman of Burragate in New South Wales has been bankrupted by New South Wales Forests. That's a New South Wales government department. Mr. Weedman got involved in a forest protest a few years ago, and he was charged with something or other, and he was fined $500. Well, he made a big mistake. He appealed, and his fine was reduced to $100, but of course his conviction stood. So New South Wales Forests have pursued him for $23,000 in costs, which Mr. Weedman is unable to pay. So to recover their costs, the Forest Department has had Mr. Weedman declared bankrupt, and they are selling his home. And more on the subject of free speech in the wide brown land. Pity the Tasmanian surgeon Michael Vaughan, who has been prevented from having a custom number plate that says NO1080. Now, do you get the significance of the plate? Dr. Vaughan wants the world to know that he is opposed to the use of 1080 poison because it kills native animals. The Registrar of Motor Vehicles in Hobart refuses to issue the plates on the grounds that the message is political and would be viewed as inappropriate. These are the words of the Registrar, would be viewed as inappropriate by some members of the community. Well, when I last checked, that's what free speech means. Freedom to get up someone else's nose. Now, if you're thinking of entering the feral ute competition at Charters Towers next month, here are the criteria that the judges will be applying in picking the winner. Points in the feral ute competition will be given for the number of dents, the length of time since the last wash, the number of socks and underpants found stuffed behind the seat, the smell, the number of different coloured panels and foxtails on aerials. Lesser points will be awarded for dead chocolate wrappers and curly sandwiches, because these are considered to be more or less de rigueur for any ute, feral or otherwise. And the only real bummer in the judging criteria is that your ute has to be roadworthy. I think they're sissies. News comes from the Northern Territory of the excommunication of a lesbian couple from the Hope City Church in Darwin. The congregation has been told to shun the naughty women and not to eat with them or say good day to them in the street. The case has been referred to the Territory Anti-Discrimination Commission, which seems a bit unnecessary to me. To paraphrase Groucho, why would anyone want to belong to a club that wouldn't have them? Now, here's a terrific idea from South Australia, where local councils are being asked to consider a really radical method for cracking down on litter bugs. It's so simple that it takes your breath away. Why not write down the car registration number on every Big Mac wrapper and chip bucket sold at the takeaway window? Then every piece of fast food litter can be traced back to the villain who throws it from the car. The McDonald's franchise manager for South Australia, Chris O'Neill, thinks that the idea has some merit. So that's a good sign. And a number of councils are said to be considering the idea. Now, finally, an apology. Last week we scoffed at the Email a Prayer service, which is offered at www.pray.com.au. But it seems that we underestimated the demand for a cyber age contact with the Almighty. Church resources, who run the system on God's behalf, say that they're getting 1,000 hits a day, and about 100 people a day are signing up to get God's email address. Not only that, but related to that, it's reported that Mr. Gibson's Jesus epic, The Passion of the Christ, is sending repentant sinners back to church in droves. Church attendances have increased since the film went on exhibition. Make of that what you will. And stand by for a terrific idea, open source biotechnology. Now, I think it's true to say that there are two broad objections to genetic modification of useful plants. One of the objections can be summarised in that it kills butterflies, which is a sort of metaphor for the feared tendency of modified plants to spread sterility in the biosphere. The other objection is that GM is a science that favours big corporations, mainly American, and works against the interests of farmers, mainly in the poor countries. Well, we'll talk about genetic engineering, but we'll forget the butterflies for the moment, and we'll concentrate on the business aspects of GM and the tendency to monopoly control of modified organisms. What if you could have genetic modification without corporate monopoly? With me in our Canberra studios is Professor Richard Jefferson, who reckons that you can have the benefits of genetic manipulation without the monopolistic consequences that worry us pessimistic Marxist depressives. Richard is the director of Cambia. That's the Centre for the Application of Molecular Biology to International Agriculture, an organisation affiliated with Charles Sturt University and supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. Richard, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Terry.
Now, let's start with the concept. You'd better explain what open source is.
Ah, well, I'm glad we have a chance to start in exciting places like that instead of the usual genetic engineering issues.
We'll open forget source. The butterflies today. We won't talk about butterflies.
No butterflies.
No
all
butterflies.
Right.
No.
Okay, there goes those notes. All right, open source is a fascinating concept that some people are used to thinking of as free software, and they think of it in the in the IT industry and software engineering. But in fact, it's extraordinarily pervasive new mode of innovation that's way beyond free. It's way into sharing. It's basically the ultimate democratization of the ability to innovate. And right now, the pointy end of the stick is in software, and we want to change that a bit.
Explain, perhaps if you use the Linux project
as
an illustration for how open source works.
Splendid. And actually, to hear a touch about how it started is interesting, and it shows where it may go. About 15, 18 years ago, a Marxist depressive named Richard Stallman at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, pioneered a concept called free software. He was irate at monopoly control of software manifest by copyrights and manifest by the fact that it was closed. That is, the source code that allowed a creative person to tinker and make something better was withheld by the nature of the software's provision called compiled. It was withheld from tinkering. And he found that a serious abridgment of his interpretation of human rights. And so he started the Free Software Foundation, and he started what amounted to a movement to craft one's own software. But he did a brilliant thing, and that is that he used intellectual property law, in this case copyright law, to actually build a community of sharing. Instead of the usual thought that intellectual property would deny people access, what this time he did was by developing something called the General Public License. As he and his colleagues crafted more and better software, they said, you can share it, and you can share it with no financial cost, but, and there's a big but, you have to agree to share your improvements with everyone else as well. So it was a situation where great creative innovators were able to say, you may not steal this innovation, but you can use it. But when you do use it, you share. And that was a pioneering breakthrough, and it led to the development, ultimately, of a sort of a proto-operating system, or in a sense, a beginnings of an alternative to Windows and to the other industrial operating systems. But it wasn't until a young Finnish computer scientist named Linus Torvalds entered the scene that it became an absolute world-changing initiative. What happened was that Linus, back in the early 90s, was toying with what's called the kernel, the guts of an operating system. And he went out into the Internet, which was in its early forms then, and said, listen, I've got what I think is the beginnings of something like Unix, which is a very popular commercial operating system, but I want to make it available for everyone, anyone interested in helping. So he made his kernel available out there, but tied it to this general public license. And within a matter of a couple or 3 years, there were literally tens of thousands of programmers trying to help to make a public good and keeping it bound as a public good with GPL. And now what do we have? We have the Marxist enterprises of IBM and Hewlett-Packard strongly endorsing Linux as a major operating system and as a complement or alternative to Windows, to Microsoft.
What's their motive, do you think, Richard? Is it just that they hate Microsoft, or are they really interested in making an operating system freely available to anybody?
I think any sensible business person would have to grimace at the concept that either IBM, Hewlett-Packard, or Intel are in it purely out of philanthropy. They see that good business can be done without egregious terms. You don't have to have complete competition and testosterone mist to actually make money. You can actually say that the core tools of innovation, which would be the operating systems, the programming languages, the interoperability standards, those tools themselves are needed by everyone. And they're going to be achieved ultimately by everybody, but at a terrible cost. But if it's shared, then pretty much everyone has a chance to benefit by making operations, making applications that actually make money.
I have to ask you one more question about the Linux model, or the Mozilla model, and that is that although I presume if you're a really clever computer geek, you can get hold of the operating system and you can make it work yourself, but there are commercial enterprises which have taken the Linux system, added their name to it, like Red Hat is I think one, and Lindows, and you know there are a couple of others. So there are companies which are profiting from this freely constructed operating system. Now, on what basis do they get permission to do that?
Oh, it's the nature of the license. And in fact, one of the evolutions of the general public license, or the free software concept that turned into open source, was exactly the ability to accommodate proprietary interests and capital needs. As an example, if you've ever used Apple's new operating system, OS 10.3, it's utterly fabulous. I love it. One of the things that's fabulous about it is it never seems to crash. And one of the reasons it never seems to crash is that they used as the core an open source Unix-like operating system called BSD Unix. But the exciting thing about that Unix is it's open source, but it was developed with a variant on the general public license that said, you can use this for free, meaning no financial cost. You share improvements to the core technology with the whole community, but if you develop a proprietary enhancement that's your own and built into your own system, you can sell that, and good luck to you. And the beautiful thing about it is it allows the good part of capitalism, meaning small, medium enterprise competition, to occur without the bad part, which is the giant barriers to innovate.
Now, let's talk about the application of this concept to biotechnology. First of all, there was presumably an area in which the developers of Linux could move that wasn't restricted by patents. But the impression that we have is that Monsanto now have tied up with patents every possible approach to genetic engineering, and that there's no room left for you to play in.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult, I admit. And I wouldn't put all of it at poor old Monsanto's doorstep, though they certainly figure strongly into it. And also, in developing this dialogue that involves corporations. Remember that three of the six big multinationals involved in biotechnology and agriculture are European. So lest it seem too much that it's an American versus European criterion, we should remember that. And they own an awful lot of the intellectual property. So you're right. It's a very challenging landscape. So we have to do it, in a sense, in two halves. One is to understand the landscape that's out there in patents, and the other is to envision ways forward that are potentially win-win, the way the Linux system has become.
Have any of the patent owners threatened to sue you for infringement?
No, they haven't. And in fact, most of them are in very constructive dialogues with us. I've had three meetings with the CEO of Monsanto, a similar number with the top brass at DuPont, Syngenta, and other companies, because basically, if one gets rid of the polemic about companies being evil and accept the fact that they're there and they're out there to actually produce products, whether it's by manipulating or addressing the market, that's another issue. Nonetheless, they have a lot of intellectual property. They have a lot of creative and very substantial science and quality assurance capacity. So the question is really, how can you develop a culture change, a new business model that they can accommodate, which doesn't cause confrontation? If it does cause confrontation, I don't think anyone's going to win in this. So in fact, I don't think they'll come after us hard because it's in their best interest to enjoy the fruits of this labor.
One of the things about the application of the open source concept to the development of computer software is that there has to be, presumably, a group of highly motivated and altruistic, umpires, arbiters, who make sure that last night's contribution to the code represents an advance, isn't going to cause mischief, isn't going to make people's computers blow up. Now, in the field of biotechnology, the equivalent to that is, who's going to do the testing of the products?
That's a marvelous question, and it's not a trivial one. I've got to say that anybody who can answer difficult questions in a single bullet point is probably pulling your leg. We can take, in a sense, the development of the Linux system and the countless other open source innovations as sort of a bellwether. And let's say, how could we learn from their successes and their failures? I'll give you an example that's very tangible, Terry, if I can. You take the technology of genetic analysis. Let's not talk about genetic engineering. And in fact, this whole initiative called BIOS is all about biological innovation for open society, not just genetic engineering. But let's take the example of genetic analysis. In other words, knowing who begat who when you do plant breeding, to know which is the a parent of a particular apple or wheat or barley so that you could make a better and more resistant or productive crop. And that technology is one that's changing rapidly, and our institution, Cambia, has been very lucky to have a terrific tame in-house genius that has the same altruistic philosophy that you're hearing about in this open source movement, Anjay Killian. And he invented a technology that is world-beating in the idea of genetic analysis. That is using, in a sense, genetic chips or small silicon chips to fingerprint germplasm, so fingerprint wheat or barley or sheep or cattle, to actually know how do we possibly do very conventional breeding to get better crops. And he invented that, and we did something very interesting that was inspired by how the open source model evolved, and that is we patented it. But we patented it and said anyone can use it for free, but you must share improvements. And so the idea that there are people who are inventing at the cutting edge and deciding that it is not just altruism, but it is satisfactory implementation of democracy that they're after, it works. And this is working beautifully. Even the Australian grains industry is benefiting from it enormously. And Andre started the first biotech open source company called Diversity Array Technologies Company, specifically to provide added value services. But the exciting thing is, anyone else could start a company using the same technology because it's freely available.
You're listening to The National Interest, and I'm talking to Professor Richard Jefferson, who is the director of Cambia, the Centre for the Application of Molecular Biology to International Agriculture. Now, before we get on to the implications for international agriculture, I did mention that you are supported by the Rockefeller Foundation, and John D. Rockefeller was at one stage the most reviled monopoly capitalist in the United States, who even had laws passed to restrain him. When did the Rockefeller Foundation become so altruistic in its motives?
Well, first, as soon as it became a foundation, one of the features of American tax law and American foundation law is that the Rockefeller Foundation, from its very inception, had to be extremely distinct in its operations, in its style, in its ownership, and in its patterns of disbursement of money from the corporations that founded it. So, for instance, in the U.S., if there were the equivalent of a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which, curiously, there is, they have to be completely and totally distinct from the source of their money, which was originally the Microsoft shares that Bill Gates owned personally. So the same thing applies to Rockefeller Foundation. The foundation itself has a completely distinct identity manifest by its board of directors, which are usually august and wonderful individuals, including people like the actor Alan Alda or the cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And they're taken in new directions of philanthropy that have nothing to do with big oil.
Or with creating new monopolies.
Now, there you go. In fact, they want to break them.
Yeah. Well, now, getting to this, the issue of the application of what you're doing to international agriculture. Now, I should have said that there's a third reason why people have misgivings about genetic modification or genetic engineering or biotechnology, and that is because we just simply can't understand it. But I've read a bit about what you're doing, and I'm going to attempt a synopsis, and then you'll correct me. But we're accustomed to thinking, insofar as we have any popular thoughts at all about genetic engineering, it's based on the concept of taking a gene from one organism and introducing it into another organism where you don't think it has any relationship. Now, I'm thinking here, of course, of the famous example of the gene taken from the fish and put into the strawberry to make the strawberry frost resistant, and presumably it didn't work because the strawberry tasted like a sardine. But as I understand, you're concentrating your research on genes that already exist in plants but may not be active in the particular plant which is being grown, and looking at ways of switching on that gene. Is that right?
That's actually a brilliant synopsis. It doesn't reflect our entire scope of work, but it certainly reflects something of our philosophy, and that is that out there in the genetics that we have to work with, there's a huge amount of intrinsic diversity and a huge amount of potential, latent potential, in the genes that you or I have, or bananas, or bureaucrats. Well, let's not push it. And we have a certain opportunity to look at why is one plant different than another. Very often it's just the orchestration of the genes. It's not a matter of banging in completely new genes. It's a matter of changing the patterns of orchestration. And the toolkit, the capability of orchestrating those genes is something that is also latent in the plant or in the organism. So what we're trying to do is develop the toolkit that allows us to harness that capacity. So that, for instance, let me give you a really tangible example. In West Africa, rice is an extremely popular component of the diet. But Asian rice, which we like very much, and in fact many West Africans would choose to eat, tends to have narrow leaves. And one of the biggest challenges in West Africa is weeds. Now, in West Africa, rices are grown that maybe don't have the same cooking and eating quality, but they have wide leaves. Okay, so they shade out the weeds, and they can actually affect a better yield under challenging conditions. Well, what if we could ask, as it were, or even demand that the Asian rice we enjoy actually had wide leaves? Turns out that the growth and development of leaf is intrinsic to the genetics of the plant, but a very subtle change, so subtle you wouldn't even be able to see it, is all that's needed when a plant evolves from a wide to a narrow or a narrow to a wide leaf. Can we master that technology? Absolutely.
Absolutely. You finished on the word absolutely. Well, what are the demands for modified organisms in the third world? You've given that one example. What are the others? I mean, like a wheat that'll grow without water, or what do they need you think you can supply through this open source approach?
Well, first, one of the most important features about open source is that it's about democracy. It's really not about a bunch of guys in suits fixing problems in the third world. It's about the fact that you've got about 4.5-5 billion people, the bottom side of the economic pyramid, who are as creative as you or I are, Terry. And the issue is, can we get tools into their hands for them to solve their problems? It's not about us feeding the third world. It's about treating them with respect and allowing the third world to do what it desires to do. This is a really key feature of this revolution we're trying to start, because it really is capturing the creative capacity of people who are currently out of the loop. So rather than say the third world needs this or that crop, what I can say the third world really needs is a little respect and a toolkit that allows them to operate without massive capital constraints. right now, you know, you pointed it out in the introduction, Terry, you did it really well, in the saying that we think of it as being big money driving modern science. And in fact, our public agencies are gormless gits also, because they seem to believe it too. And previously, where we had what I call a representational technocracy, where we used to have public agencies and small, medium enterprise we used to trust delivering new innovations, you know, including classical modifications of crops and cropping systems, we seem not to anymore. We only seem to see public agencies that are apologists for getting in bed with multinationals. And there may not be something bad about multinationals if we have an alternative. I mean, nobody really hates Microsoft as long as they've got lots of opportunities to buy other stuff. And it's the same here.
But there's no getting away from the fact that every state government in Australia is in competition with every other state government in establishing biotechnology research centres, which they hope will have economic benefits for the state rather than just doing good for mankind.
You're pushing all my right buttons here, Terry. Economic benefits. And yet, you know, you hear the mewling cries that there's a triple bottom line that we have to consider. There's the economic issues, there's the social issues, and there's the environmental issues. So we hear it put out large in that beautiful copy that we see in those lovely brochures from state and federal government agencies, CSIRO, about this triple bottom line. And after they said it, they ignore it. The issue is really our public agencies and our small, medium enterprise are perfectly poised to look very hard at the issues of social and environmental added value, not simply measurable economic short-term returns. So what I'd say is that we actually have a crisis in business management and business models that are unable to accommodate the true triple bottom line. And we can get there without, in a sense, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And the baby is excellent science and committed scientists. But the bathwater is this appalling lack of bottle in the public agencies. And the lack of understanding that you don't have to have big money to do big impact work.
Well, Richard, the last question is, what have you produced? I understand that there are 40 scientists associated with the Cambia project, and some money has obviously been spent on your research. Have you produced anything yet?
Yeah, quite a bit. And in fact, Andrzej Killian's invention is just one of them, but it's a major one. Others that he's also been involved in, that I've been involved in, are the technique we were talking to you about amending genomes without putting in flounder genes. But others are a little bit more drum-beating. We actually have a lot of success with interacting with both industry and public sector. The main tool in genetic engineering is one we were associated with developing, but then we did something unusual in the early days, and that is we made it available to absolutely everyone based on their ability to pay. So, for instance, the Hawaiian Papaya Growers Cooperative of small farmers in Hawaii that were faced with a disastrous virus problem, they, using public sector colleagues at Cornell University in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they invented a solution to that. It wasn't Monsanto. It wasn't DuPont. It was a bunch of farmers, and it was a creative university professor. And they used the technologies that we invented. And so this is becoming commonplace, and we have actually been able to successfully intervene at the point of inventing tools. We're not very good, I must say, at delivering finished products per se. We're extraordinarily good at developing tools. And the other side, what we've delivered, we have the largest, fastest public access database on Earth of patents. We've spent 5 years and a lot of Rockefeller Foundation's money with some help from the grains industry of Australia to develop a completely non-closed database of every patent we can get our hands on Earth. And it is fast and it's phenomenal. And that allows us to see something important. If you want to make something free, you have to know what's not.
Richard, thank you very much for your time. Next time you come, you can bring your mandolin. You haven't got your mandolin with you, I suppose.
I do not. I left
I could have asked you to play our intermezzo on your mandolin.
I'd have loved it. I charged you.
I read everywhere that this is your true interest is playing the mandolin, and that biotechnology is your spare time job.
Exactly.
Richard, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Terry, for having me on the show. I appreciate it very much.
Professor Richard Jefferson, who is the director of Cambia, the Centre for the Application of Molecular Biology to International Agriculture. It's a centre which is affiliated with Charles Sturt University and, as I said, supported by the Rockefeller Foundation.